BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Sunita Alain. She made history recently when she became the 41st Master of Jesus College, Cambridge, an institution dating back to the 15th century. She's the first woman to hold the post and, more significantly, the first black master of any Oxbridge college. She is, however, used to making change. She was the CEO and co-founder of the media production house Something Else, a company at the forefront of the digital revolution in broadcasting. She's a former board member of the BBC Trust, the London Legacy Development Corporation, and the Radio Academy. Her media career grew out of a lifelong love of music, especially jazz, and her desire to find out what happens when you improvise isn't confined to her record collection. She says, "I was always trying to make something happen for myself rather than waiting for someone to give me permission. You can't wait for people to notice you. You have to have agency." Sunita Alain, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Being here is harder than childbirth. Having to kind of pick your music for your life. It's really hard.
Well, just keep breathing. We'll get through it. It's going to be okay. Yeah. So let's start then with the importance of that idea of agency. What is it? What does it mean to you and why does it matter?
Agency represents a lot of things. It represents that moment when you realise that your life is in your hands. It's the moment when you can look around you and you can see all the things that stack up against you and you still think your life is in your hands. It's about taking knocks and just thinking, OK, I've got a problem, how am I going to get round this one? It's so visceral, it's so embedded in us as human beings, I think, agency.
And was there a moment that it arrived for you?
I think I've always had that kind of push, which has always been there through my childhood. I've been the kind of stalwart, kind of standing there. Some would say a little bit stubbornly, but, you know, just standing there going, right, I'm leaning in, I'm going for it. I think the moment for me was actually when I'd gone to Cambridge. I went there to do computer science. It was in the days when you couldn't do computer science for 3 years because it wasn't deemed to be something that you would study for 3 years. And I went there because I was really interested in artificial intelligence and very interested in philosophy. And I did philosophy for the first year. And when I got to the summer, I rang my parents and said, I'm going to stick with philosophy. I'm not going to do artificial intelligence. And it was one of those moments when you're imagining jetting off to MIT and that door is closing and you're opening a door where you don't know what's going to happen. That was quite exciting.
We'll come back to that. Your appointment at Cambridge made headlines. Why did you want the job?
I wanted the job because I enjoyed my time at Cambridge. But it wasn't one of those jobs where I went for it thinking, I'm going to make headlines doing this, because that's not what life is about. You go for jobs looking at very, very practical issues, like what's the community like that I'm going to be joining? Is it somewhere where you want your family to be for 10 years? Is it a good adventure? And it's not about the buildings. Cambridge is very beautiful. But you don't talk to a 15th century wall. You don't do that. You talk to the person who works there.
It's time to go to the music. It's been a tough task for you to choose your 8 discs today. I know. Tell us about your first. What are we going to hear? And why has this made the cut?
Well, this is Gary Bartz and NTU troupe, I've Known Rivers. It's based on a poem by Langston Hughes. This has made the cut because it's a fundamental piece of music for me. I love jazz. Jazz has been a constant throughout my life. And this is about journeys that connect people. We all have them. We all take them. And for me, the notion of knowing rivers which kind of flow through the world that are really connected and that take you places, I think that's really, really excellent. And it's quite a melodic piece of music. I don't mind discordant, though, because I think that sometimes in life's journeys, you need a little bit of rapids, a little bit of unsettling. Too much smooth is not a good thing. So a little bit of rapids in your rivers and your journeys through life, I think, is very, very important. And this, for me, is all about connection.
Let's get in the canoe.
Rivers I have seen and rivers I have known, ancient than the world and older than the blood. I've known rivers I've known river all through Africa and North America, South America and Australia. I've known river, I've known river, I've known rivers in the north and the south. I've known rivers in the east and the west. I've known rivers all over this world. I've sailed some and seen the rest. I've known rivers, I've known rivers, I've known rivers, ancient dusky rivers. And my soul has grown deep like the rivers, the rivers, the rivers, like the rivers.
Gary Bartz and NTU troupe I've Known Rivers. Sunita Alain, both Cambridge and Oxford universities as a whole have been criticised for the low numbers of BAME students being given places. Now, at Cambridge, black students now number around 3% of new undergraduates, 26.8% BAME students in total. It isn't a real change needed in the application process?
What do you mean by that?
The entrance requirement for students is 3 A-stars, so won't that inevitably disadvantage students from state schools, in particular perhaps from disadvantaged areas and schools that don't have as many facilities as the counterparts of those kids who are privately educated?
I think there's a conversation to be had around the fact that Cambridge is a bastion of excellence, and actually, you know, people can meet that level. I think what tends to happen is that there's myths around Cambridge. To get into Cambridge at GCSE level, in old money terms, you need 4 A grades. I think what happens is that teachers then don't know that. And then potential students who could think about going to Cambridge are put off because they think they haven't got their collection of 9 A stars at GCSE.
Is the interview a barrier, do you think?
From what I've seen, that Jesus, we've just been through our kind of interview process. The team there are really, really good at trying to get the best out of people. So I don't think it's a barrier. And we're also doing a lot of things where we're reaching out to look at children who are from communities of care, reaching out to students who are from disadvantaged backgrounds. They may not have got through the interview the first time, but they go into an adjustment process, which means that after they've got their A-levels, and often these are students who are coming out with 4 A-stars, Cambridge then goes back to them and says, will you still consider us? And it puts the power back in those students' hands.
So you think the onus is on the students as well?
Every year there's a group of people in the UK who are 16, 17, 18. Every year the world is new for them. And I think that if you begin to keep absorbing the stories from the past, which basically say, you're not there, that is a self-perpetuating thing. I think that if the conversation is about, look, this is one of your 5 choices, have a go, I think that's fine. Also, I think that if the story is the atmosphere at an Oxbridge college is going to be different to the atmosphere when you go to, you know, a different university, a different Russell Group, well, actually, no, it's probably not. There could be a few traditions which are a bit different, but what you come up against as a young person going out into the world is probably the same. You might as well go for it.
There's been a lot of talk about the Stormzy effect. He funds 2 places for black students at Cambridge. Has that made an impact on the numbers applying?
Yeah, I think it probably has. It's made an impact in that the media talks about it.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Throughout my life, the media has influenced a lot. So sometimes journalists are kind of go, oh, what about Cambridge and Oxford? What are you doing? But actually, what's the myth that you're perpetuating by constantly saying, oh, students are finding it hard, should you be lowering grades? No, because I think about the people I went through Cambridge with. They are brilliant. They're intellectually capable. And so, no, I think we need to get more people to apply. We need to get more people to think, yeah, I deserve that. That's what I should be doing.
It's time to go to your second disc. Why have you chosen it, Sunita?
Well, this is Minnie Riperton Les Fleurs. This takes me right back to my childhood. I was brought up in East London, Walthamstow and Leytonstone, and I was very highly influenced by my brother. And he was very much into jazz funk. There was a combination of his record collection, looking at my parents' record collection. My parents were quite keen on us doing a lot of education. That's why they travelled 4,000 miles from Barbados. And I think this track, I do remember playing it over and over again and really loving the production, loving the big drop. At the time, probably wouldn't have used that term, but noticing that and going, yeah, it's really big. There's a kind of expansiveness to it, which I think all 11 and 12-year-olds should experience.
Minnie Riperton and Les Fleurs, all about the crescendo, Sunita Alleyne. So as you mentioned, you were born in Barbados, lived there until you were three. You'd settled with your parents and two siblings in East London. How would you describe family life there?
My very first memory I remember was walking up the stairs. It's kind of typical two up, two down terraced house in Walthamstow, and the stairs being quite steep. I remember as a two or two and a half, thinking, wow, I can't get my legs up the stairs. I must have compared it to the stairs in Barbados in my grandmother's house. But all three of us shared the same bedroom. My parents had their own bedroom, but they had a little side table, and we'd climb on the side table, climb on the doorknobs of a cupboard next to it, climb all the way to the top of the cupboard, and then launch ourselves onto the bed. And also I remember trying to catch pigeons in the backyard with a box. And it was like one of those things you see on cartoons, and it's like there's some breadcrumbs there.
Yeah, would have been on TV at the time, for sure.
Breadcrumbs and a little cardboard box and a little string, and sitting there waiting for a pigeon. I didn't know what I was going to do with the pigeon when
no.
I got it, but
hopefully the pigeon's too wise to this kind of game.
I'm still trying to catch them. And I remember I learnt to read before I went to school. At school, when I first started, my Bajan accent was much stronger. I remember they put me in a special class and my mother got me out of there. And she said, no, that's just the way she talks.
And what were your feelings about that?
It's the battles your parents have for you. I was quite aware of, of being black from quite an early age, actually. And my parents, especially my dad, was always talking about what happened to them in the country when they'd come over. He was quite strong on that. I think that, as a parent, you want to warn your children that this is coming. But I think for me, it was taking that warning and saying, I don't want that warning to box me in. I don't want that warning to make me think I can't do something.
How did your parents handle it?
They're quite formidable. My mum, she's a very, very practical person. A lot of common sense. It was difficult for them, but there was a whole sense of community of people who'd come over from the Caribbean. There'd always be someone popping in. So there was that sense of community. I think from my perspective, I felt very special because I could read, because the head teacher would let me go in and pick my books and later on helping other people read. But also I had one person say to me, don't answer all the questions all the time, because the boys don't know the answers. And that's really damaging. What do you mean, the boys? What's that got to do with it? So you get that realisation, your childhood goes away from you because you realise what the world is about.
Do you remember your first barrier that you came up against?
That's a good question. It's a good question because most times in life you've overcome them because you're sitting there. So sometimes there are things that you can't do, but you just swerve around them. Maybe it's the way in which my mind is wired. They cease to be barriers as they flow past you in the flow of time. You don't really think about the things that you didn't do.
You said that as a kid you were aware of being black. What did that mean to you then? What did it feel like? How did that manifest?
I would just think about it. I was born in 1967. The backdrop to my life at that point was television. It was so important that I remember getting our first television and you weren't on it. And when you were on it, you were being disparaged.
And did you notice it at the time?
Oh, yeah. At the time, you're always watching a comedy show with a little bit of an edge to it. What are they going to say? Is there going to be some sort of disparaging bit of comedy coming out about you? I think as you go through life, you get very angry about it. I think as you get older, you kind of cope with it a little bit more. But there's definitely that, oh, here we are again. And you have those moments all through life. You just cope with them better.
Let's take a break for some music. It's disc number 3. Tell me about this one.
OK, this is L.J. Reynolds' Key to the World. And this, for me, is a really big connection at the time. East London, Leytonstone, lovers rock. Slower reggae, but very melodic, you know, close dancing. We don't do close dancing enough, but maybe I don't go out enough. For me, the connection was Rudy Thomas, Key to the World. So you've got that connection from the Caribbean with reggae coming into Be Lovers Rock, which for me was a very London thing. It was the music where I was accepted. It wasn't on the mainstream. But this is the LJ Reynolds, which is an American version of it. Again, a really, really big sound, live music, uplifting.
LJ Reynolds and Key to the World. Sunita Aline, our teenage years are often a time of self-discovery. What were you about back then?
Oh, music. I played the viola, went to orchestra. I didn't start performing and singing until I went to university. And then for me, going to Cambridge was a kind of microcosm of the world. You can reinvent yourself, you can try things, you can do things, you can perform for the first time. The adventure is starting. And life sometimes is more exciting when you say yes.
So, talking of saying yes to things, how did you come to apply to Cambridge?
Really good school, which was in Leytonstone. Really good head teacher and deputy head teacher. And they took us along to visit one of the girls who had gone to Cambridge already. She looked really happy. Now, I remember the expanse and the beauty of the college. And so you think, yeah, this is a place I could fit. And then the process of going for Cambridge was exhilarating. There was a few of us who went for it. I think it was about five or six girls who did Latin, who had extra lessons in thinking. And it was that moment when you escape the blackboard. And by escape the blackboard, I mean that we still have a system where you're going through the process because you have to answer certain questions in a certain way to get your mark. But for me, that was the first time when someone said, "What do you think?" Everything you'd read, everything you'd watched, all your opinions, were able to say, well, you are now a free thinker. Welcome. Welcome to the world of free thinking. For me, that was an amazing process. I remember going up for my interview and the woman who became my supervisor, I just had a brilliant time for an hour with her. And whether or not I got in or not, I left that interview feeling really, really buoyant because we'd had a really good discussion. We talked about value. We talked about artificial intelligence and it just felt like I was noticed.
We've got to go to the music. It's your fourth today. Tell us about this one.
This is my typical Cambridge track. I went to Fitzwilliam. It was all about late night conversations, swapping of ideas, swapping of stories and swapping of music. When I went to Cambridge, I didn't feel people had my same musical journey. But then I was quite open to that sense of adventure. And Tom Waits was introduced to me at that point. And I love Tom Waits. I may be the first master of an Oxbridge college to have an album of the week on my notice board. My album this week is Rain Dogs by Tom Waits. But this is Martha. There's a real beauty to being able to capture an emotion and in one song tell a story, which is so sad that it actually becomes beautiful. And then you kind of think, yeah, you're a genius.
Operator, number please. It's been so many years. She remembered my old voice while I fight the tears. Hello, hello, there is this Martha, this is old Tom Frost. And I am calling long distance, don't worry about the cost.
Tom Waits and Martha from the album Closing Time. Sunita Aline, you arrived at Cambridge in 1985 as a student. What were your first impressions?
For me, it was the sense of difference. I'm very sociable. And I think after the first term, I knew everyone in my year. And it was a sense of freedom. There was a moment when I thought, there's two ways I can do this. I can go full on in the library, or I can go full on into life. So I did student politics. I did organising again on sort of the May Ball committee. I joined a band. I put myself out there. Marches. Everyone should go on a march. South Africa, it was anti-racism. Those were the things that I was very concerned with at the time.
So you made a lot of connections, but you did mention earlier that Cambridge was by no means as diverse then as it is now. How was that for you?
It was very close to a sort of black students group, which I still have today. I think it's one of those places where you'd nod to people you didn't know who were black. You're having a shared experience of being different and being here. So that was a support. Other communities for me were the jazz community. My first trip out of Fitzwilliam on my own into town was to go to the Cambridge Modern Jazz Club. I tried journalism as well. So I felt a difference, but I didn't sort of stay in that small. You know, I was doing so much other stuff and meeting so many different people.
And your subject was philosophy, of course. What did studying that give to you?
I think the academic rigour of being able to analyse large pieces of text and drill down to what is the issue here, that's what philosophy gave me. Very, very practical outlook in life.
After your time at Cambridge, your first job was working in insurance. You were cold calling.
Oh, yeah.
How and why?
Well, philosophy is not like medicine or law. It's not like, oh, right, the country needs 500 philosophers. So I didn't know what I wanted to do when I left Cambridge and just picked out a job. I'll go for that interview. Very random. I ended up going into this cold calling. And I have to say, it was a very good thing to do because it meant that you have to talk to anyone. I think everyone should do a sales job. Any business job you do, I think that's a valuable thing to do.
We're going to have to take a pause in the conversation for some music now. It's your fifth disc. Why this one?
This is Arrested Development in Tennessee. You talked about the fact that I started off in insurance. My career then led me to deciding to go for music. And when I set up my radio production company in 1991, I was putting on gigs and events to get cash flow going. And Arrested Development were the big band that were there at the time. And this was one of the gigs that we put on. I mean, this is one of the albums I walk to. I like walking. And sometimes if you have to exercise, you think, oh, it's not about the walk. It's about the music.
Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing dress. Although I am black and brass, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. But Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force of truth. For some strange reason it had...
Arrested Development and Tennessee. Sunita Alain, you found work at Jazz FM. That was a station that was at the forefront of this new independent radio sector that was flowering in the early 90s. How did you get the gig there?
In between cold calls, I had this moment. Well, I just thought, do you know what? I'm going to spend a lot of my life working. I better do something that I enjoy. So I rang up Jazz Services, which connected jazz across the UK. Rang them up and said, hi. And really important cold call. Hello, I'm Sunita. I want to work in jazz. Can you call me if there's something that comes up? Mm-hmm. What came up was working for a small jazz publishing company. That job came to an end. And then I remember being unemployed for a bit. And I went to a Cassandra Wilson gig. I then also went to a Jazz Against Apartheid meeting. And there was a guy there who was at both of those events. And he said, oh, you look like a journalist. And I, of course, you know, having written a couple of things for the Student Union magazine, oh, yes, 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 I am. And then he said, oh, we're starting Jazz FM. You must come along for a meeting. That was when I got into Jazz FM.
The recession hit the station in 1991 and you were made redundant then. So you then pooled enough cash to form something else with some of your Jazz FM colleagues. So Jez Nelson and Chris Phillips, 500 quid each, I think. You built it up to be a very successful company. Looking back, what do you think was your most important contribution?
Well, I think as a CEO, it was the risk-taking, getting to the crux of the matter that we sold creativity and how to move from radio into digital media. The first start, I think, was probably the radio station we did up in Edinburgh. Festival FM at the time that the government were giving out restricted service licences so you could run a radio station for 28 days.
So now we'd call it a pop-up radio station, but this was before that idea.
Before that, yeah. And you're sat in one little office going, right, how do we get noticed? It was a community of people who were striving for something. It was a blank piece of paper. So I think that's what's exciting about that time.
It sounds like an adventure. I mean, you've built a very successful business career out of a love of culture that isn't necessarily mainstream. I wonder what lessons you've been able to learn from the creative people that you admire, those lessons that have been useful in the business world. What have you taken away?
That you don't necessarily have to accept the rules, that the world isn't necessarily as it's given to you. We've been trained to accept rules. You go to school when you're three, you're running around, there's no gap between talking and thinking. We get to sit on a mat, 30 kids on a mat, and then you're taught to put your hand up, to wait for someone to pick you to speak. And I just think that maybe we're inculcating right from a very, very young age the need for someone to say, you can do it, and deciding that the world is a huge, adventurous paint set for you to have a go at.
Let's have some more music.
This is from that time, and it was when I met my partner in life. I ended up living in Stoke Newington in a 5-bedroom house with a good friend, Lynn Champion, and a daughter, Lauren, she was 2.5. And it was a party house. The time when you could have 3 sound systems in a 5-bedroom house, one on each floor. And this is from a band called Outside, To Forgive But Not Forget. And this encapsulates that whole melting pot excitement of Stoke Newington.
To Forgive But Not Forget. Sunita Elaine, you met your partner, James McCarthy, around the time that track was released. The two of you have a son, Miro, and he's a teenager now. How did you adjust to motherhood, especially during what must have been a very busy time in your professional life?
I did maternity leave for 4 months. I mean, every woman has got their birth story. But I remember, as well as packing stuff to go to the hospital for the birth, we had a big CD player and we had a bag full of CDs and music. It's really important, like, what music will you be born to? That was the thing that was going through my head.
Did you get time to put any of them on?
We did. We put on loads of music.
Good.
I think it was maybe one of the most bizarre nights in the maternity ward because there was lots of free jazz being played quite loudly. And there was one point when it was, okay, enough. No more music. I'm just pushing, right?
Even so, a jazz nut even, has had enough
even
at this point.
I don't want the music. Just give me gas. So that was my adjustment to motherhood. It was a really interesting quandary because I remember thinking, oh, you know, I had the child, I'll get back to my work and they're making really proud of me and your business will do this and we'll do that. And then there was a point in which I realised that he just wanted me to play Lego. You know.
So building up your business alongside the Lego?
Yeah, that was a good period. I think at that point we went on a business owner's course and brought in things like content management systems and really looked at how we sold and looked at the fact that we sold creativity and really expanded and took more risks. And there came a point after about 18 years when I was like, OK, time to move on. But what I had done before that was get onto different boards because I'm quite interested in bigger issues around society. So I was on the Department of Culture and Media and Sport as a non-exec director. Things like the National Employment Panel, which looked at the kind of welfare to work system. It's the beauty of being able to think on a bigger scale, think about issues and take your philosophy with you into different areas.
Your work's taken you across the media, of course. In the independent radio sector, you were on the board of the BBC Trust 2012 to 2017, and diversity's been a big part of your life's work. How is the media doing in that regard now?
It's better. I think behind the mic or behind the camera, not so good.
So in production, there's still work to be done.
Still a lot of work to be done in production. A lot of work to be done in terms of the hierarchy, the decision makers. There's still a big way to go, actually.
So the public-facing side better, but behind the scenes...
Yeah, kind of better. But, you know, when it comes down to the stories that are told from a working class perspective or from a woman's perspective or black perspective, you need to have more people in the mix creatively. You need to have more people in the mix in terms of power and economic power. For me, equality and inclusion are about the ability for people to thrive economically and personally, to be able to go for jobs, to see a career and a trajectory for them, which is there for the taking if they want to go for it. And I think that's the problem sometimes with the media. We don't have enough people around the board table.
Let's have some more music. It's time for your seventh disc. What have you got for us?
This is definitely the Miro disc. Anyone who's a parent will know that glorious, glorious moment when they take their afternoon nap. Okay. Come on, let's just be honest about it. The afternoon nap is just really good. I remember I used to play Cassandra Wilson to Miro and hold him in my arms and he'd go to sleep. This particular track is Last Train to Clarksville and it's a Monkees track, but she totally makes this her own.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 cause I made your reservation. Don't be slow. No, no, no. Oh, no, no, no. Cause I'm leaving in the morning and I must see you again. We'll have one more night together till the morning.
Cassandra Wilson and Last Train to Clarksville. Sunita Alleyne, your college, Jesus, is part of Cambridge, which is largely publicly funded and a global brand with an enviable reputation. What do you think is the key to maintaining its prestige, particularly after Brexit?
Oh, I think it's 500 years of prestige. It's going to be OK. It's such a strong foundation. I think also one of the keys is the alumni. As you get into a community, you realise that the community stretches back through time. The things you do help it stretch forward and lay the foundation for it going forward in time.
And what about Brexit? What do you think are the main challenges that it will bring?
Form-filling. It's a really hard one because you talk about challenges, but then people don't talk about the challenges over the short term or the long term or the medium term.
Well, tell us.
For me, it's a challenge of making sure that people realise that it's something that's happening and you can either see it as a kind of wall that you've hit or you see it as something that's there and then, OK, how do we go around it? Maybe that's the business person in me. You want a little bit of certainty, but there's challenges from an academic side in terms of research grants from Europe, etc., etc. But I feel very positive. You have to build a community from a position of positivity. You know, it's happening. Let's just get on with it.
Sunita, it's time for your final disc. What is it and why have you chosen it?
This is Marvin Hannibal Peterson, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And if you see me in Jesus walking around with a big smile on my face, this is probably going through my head. This is a great, great track. It's got Deirdre Murray on cello. Who doesn't love a little bit of jazz cello? It's just brilliant.
Marvin Hannibal Peterson and Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. It's time to cast you away to the island then, Sunita Alleyne. You will be able to do some reading because we'll give you the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare and, of course, a book of your own. What would you like?
I'll probably take Michael Ondaatje and Coming Through Slaughter. the language is amazing and the story is incredible. And it's one of those books I read most years.
We can also offer you a luxury item to make your stay more enjoyable. What would you like?
I would like to take a genie in a lamp that works in the confines of my island.
Ah, presumably to generate wishes.
Well, like a little house, a swimming pool. It's one object. You know, it's not digital, it's just a genie in a lamp. That would be great.
But a house is pretty practical.
A genie could be classed as a
practical item, arguably.
Well, it's an imaginative item.
On that basis, we're going to allow it.
Thank you. Yes.
The genie is yours. Of course, I have one final question to ask you, and I think it might be the most difficult one of all for you, Sunita. If you had to save one of these 8 discs from the waves, which would it be?
Very, very difficult. I think I'm going to go for Minnie Riperton, Leffler. The genie would actually give me a really, really good sound system. And I would just play it really loud all across the island at various times. I think that's the one I would go for.
Sunita Elaine, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope Sunita will be very happy on the island. I do suspect her imagination will be put to good use. As she said, she's a huge jazz fan. Well, over the years, many jazz greats have been cast away, including Dave Brubeck, Humphrey Lyttelton, Cleo Lane, Louis Armstrong and Jamie Cullum. Back in 2001, Sue Lawley cast away the saxophonist Courtney Pine.
So let's go back to your school, recorder to clarinet to saxophone, and you started to play. Were you playing outside school in bands? What were you doing?
Yes, I started playing with a Harrow Youth local big band, which the ultimate aim was to be in the National Youth Jazz Orchestra. Mm.
But this was sort of Glenn Miller stuff.
Very much Glenn Miller, Stan Kenton, that kind of stuff.
Where did you play?
We played at ex-servicemen's clubs, and that was a real education. You know, kind of Bernard Manning kind of humour, that kind of place. And for me, being a young black man in that environment, I mean, I didn't get any trouble or anything, but it was just interesting playing music and seeing the functionality of music in that environment.
But as well as the big band, you were playing in jazz.
I was doing the jazz kind of thing, and I was doing like a popular reggae kind of thing at the same time. And I ended up literally at the age of 16 being a professional musician. And it was very interesting because I was on the road getting £20 on the weekends and coming back, falling asleep in school.
I was going to say, you were at school as well, so how could you cope?
It was very difficult, and my music teacher said, well, you are a professional musician, so you may as well leave school and continue, because this is what you want to do anyway.
But difficult for your mother to accept, because I think your mother would have had, you know, different ambitions for you.
Well, my mum is very much into the educational thing, and music wasn't a part of our family culture.
She wanted you to be a doctor, didn't she?
I was supposed to be a doctor, you know, for some strange reason. I think she saw me in the garden decapitating worms, sending them up to space or something, and thought, oh, he could be a surgeon or something.
So how did you persuade her? Because, as you say, you know, you were very well behaved. You were the boy with the knobbly knees and the shiny satchel.
Well,
exactly. So how do you suddenly persuade this mother, who's obviously quite dominant in your life, how do you suddenly say to her, excuse me, I'm not going to do this education thing?
Well, for my exams, my O-levels, I failed every single one except music. Every single one. And I think that's when it hit her that I'd made up my mind that I wanted to be a musician, you know. And also my mum seeing me going out with these Rasta men and being associated with that music, didn't take it seriously. She used to lock away my saxophones.
Did she?
And she would say, well, you better go and do the show with the Harrow Youth Big Band and not go on the road and earn £20 with this reggae band. So she was very worried for me.
Courtney Pine talking to Sue Lawley. Next time, my guest will be Radio 2 breakfast show host Zoe Ball. Do join us then.
If you're listening to some other podcast, then stop now and listen to a good one, because The Infinite Monkey Cage is back for a new series, and we're doing loads of things, aren't we, Robin?
We're going to be dealing with the science of laughter, conspiracy theories, coral reefs, quantum worlds, and finally UFOs. I love UFOs. It's also, by the way, the UFO one available to watch on iPlayer. In fact, all of the series that we've done are available on BBC Sounds.
I must say that I wouldn't bother with the first series. I don't think it's very good.
I wouldn't bother with the first two.
Yeah.
But we were played by different people then, I think, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah. Melvin Bragg was you, and...
You were Debbie McGee.
Debbie McGee. Yeah.
Bragg and McGee. Now, that is a 1980s TV detective series that I will be making.